Dr. Mike Ford. And now on BBC Radio 4 FM, the final part of our book of the week, Mary Portis's autobiography, Shop Girl. Mary is starting to build a new independent life away from her father, but the troubles in her family continue.
How are you, Mary? Dad asks.
I've got a Saturday job at Clement's department store as a floater. I go from department to department, depending on where I'm needed. I don't see Dad too often now. He doesn't work every weekend at Clement's and is either in his office or sitting in the management canteen if he does come in. I try to avoid him. It's just 18 months since Mum died, and I can't forgive him for selling our family home to move in with his new wife, Rebecca, leaving me and my brothers and sister homeless. I better be getting back. I'm in menswear today, I say, as I make my escape. I want to turn and fling myself at Dad as I walk away. I want to run to him as I did when I was a child, slip my hand into his and feel safe, because I'm more afraid now than I have ever been. No home, no money, no job. But I will not give Dad the satisfaction of asking for help. Something has hardened inside me. I have only myself to rely on. College is coming to an end, and I need a full-time job. I have my sights set on the visual merchandising department at Harrods. I don't care that they tell me all their positions are filled. I phone them every day. Anyone turned down a job? I say on a Tuesday. Are you sure there isn't a job for me? I say on a Wednesday. I'm just checking that no one has dropped out, I ask on a Thursday. Finally, 3 days after leaving college, I put on my best Miss Selfridge pencil skirt, a white shirt and stilettos, and I go up to Harrods for an interview. I get the job. Covering 4.5 acres, Harrods stretched across 7 floors. There were carpenters and chocolate makers, waiters and seamstresses, liveried liftmen and sales staff working either on the shop floor or behind the scenes for more than 300 departments. The jewel in Harrods' crown was the 72 ground floor windows, facing onto one of London's most exclusive neighbourhoods. As a junior window dresser, I'm at the bottom of the pile. I did anything that was asked of me, and I quickly learnt about the store as I went from department to department. My head is level with Berge's crotch. The head of fashion, he's queen of the store. Tall, dark, and thin as a whippet, he looked like a cross between Rudolf Nureyev and Freddie Mercury, without the buck teeth. My eyes crawl past his belt buckle, Ferragamo, towards his flaring nostrils. I'm kneeling on the floor in front of a mannequin's leg. Her head looks uncannily like Joan Collins. She is from Adele Rutstein's latest collection, and I knocked off her leg as I tried to get her through the access panel into the window. If the leg is chipped, it will have to be resprayed.
Do you know how much it costs?
Berge hisses as his assistant glares at me.
Pick it up!
I scrabble on the floor, but my hands have turned to jelly. Sweat beads on my upper lip, and my heart thumps. Finally grabbing hold of the leg, I brandish it at Berge.
Hold it properly by its middle parts next time.
I'm working harder than I've ever done before, and despite my occasional brushes with trouble, I know I've found my ideal job. But I'm still constantly worried about money. Since Dad sold our family home, I'm always aware of relying on people for a roof over my head in their already crowded homes. I know I should get my own place, but the thought of living alone just fills me with dread. I'd be so lonely. I can hardly afford it either on the amount that I earn. So I'm continually dodging fares on the underground and buying food that's discounted because it's near the end of its shelf life. I squirrel away any spare money I have to buy records by artists like Joy Division, Talking Heads and Dexys Midnight Runners. Working class kids are breaking the charts with music featuring everything from synthesizers to brass and strings. It was a few days after the Christmas windows had been unveiled, and I'd gone to see my sister Tish after work. But when I got to her flat, I found Dad's new wife, Rebecca, waiting outside in the dark. Her face crumpled in the orange glow of the streetlights. "Your father is dead," she says. Something swooped down inside me, just as it had when Mum died. That moment of going over a cliff and plunging downwards, I didn't understand. "What do you mean? Dad's not ill." "A heart attack. In his office. And we've only been married 9 months." Anger snapped as I looked at Rebecca dabbing her nose with a handkerchief, lost in her own sadness, entirely unaware of mine or how my brothers and sister will feel. When I call my boss at Harrods to let him know I won't be coming in, he says he's so sorry. That's dreadful. Dreadful. The word stuck in my mind as I put down the phone. He was right, of course. But in so many ways, Dad had been lost to us long before. For a man who'd spent his childhood in the Protestant Church, was married and raised children in the Catholic before a late conversion to Seventh-day Adventism, my father's funeral was an appropriately mixed affair when it came to religious influences. After a service in a nondescript, non-denominational church, we went to North Watford Cemetery, where Dad was buried next to Mum, as his very much alive second wife wept beside them. The solicitor told us just before the funeral that Dad had left everything to Rebecca. Money and every possession he'd ever owned. Now, it was just the five of us. When I strolled into Harrods a few months later, I was channeling part Dexys Midnight Runners, part Hazel O'Connor, wearing pinstripe baggy trousers with braces and a man's white shirt. I looked at least 3 inches taller, thanks to the blonde perm that I'd backcomb religiously each morning. I'd had to smarten up. I'd been promoted. I'd proved myself a good window dresser and was regularly asked to assist on the front windows. I'd even been allowed to accessorise a mannequin. And eventually, a day had come when my boss Bears checked what I'd done and didn't change anything. So, after almost a year there, I applied for a senior dresser's position in Harrods' younger, hipper brands in a department called Weigh In, and I got it. At first, I was doing store displays, plinths, internal windows and cases around the department. But what I'd hoped for, though, was a dedicated window on the ground floor. My new boss, Barbara, agreed. Together, we persuaded top management to give us what we wanted, our very own window. But as Barbara and I had sat down to discuss the first display that I would design for the windows, I knew it was time to misbehave a little. "We're thinking of an Arctic tundra," she said, "pastel blue cashmere and grey silk in a snowy landscape. Something eye-catching, but elegant." I sketched the window and set to work. When I was happy, I lifted the blinds and brought Barbara downstairs to see it. The mannequins were dressed in the cashmere and silk that she had requested, but they weren't standing on an Arctic plain. Instead, they were strutting down the streets of snowy New York. Lorry tyres were piled up in the corners of the window. There were black tyre tracks skidding through white snow, and a row of mannequins' legs in tights. The New York skyline twinkled behind it all on a backdrop I'd painted. Barbara gazed at the window for a long time, then smiled. "It's good," she said. "Very good." It was all the encouragement I needed. Soon those windows were full of everything from ripped tartan and thousands of love heart sweets that I stuck individually on the walls to bald mannequins wearing only sportswear and boxing gloves. By 1982, the Way In floor was full of activity, hosting a big launch of a new Mary Quant makeup line, for which I'd piled paint pots and brushes in a window that I'd painted purple. And we hosted a fashion show. Even as Britain went to war in the Falklands, the luxury world of Harrods kept forging ahead, like an ocean liner, unaffected by choppy currents. But I felt uneasy. Although Harrods had been good to me, opportunities to move upwards seemed limited. I envied my friends who were working as freelancers. They had the freedom I craved. What would I be like, unleashed on the world? One day, I was inside a window touching up a display when there was a knock on the glass. It was only Malcolm Bloody McLaren. He was standing on the pavement in a big overcoat and a buffalo hat, gesturing at me to come outside. "I've been watching your windows," he said in a distinctive drawl. "Pretty out there, aren't they? I'm surprised Harrods lets you get away with it." He gave me his card before walking away. The world was changing, and he had got me thinking. He always was good at stirring things up. My mate, Fiona, stands beside me. "Oh, it's good," she says. "You're first as a freelance. We've got to celebrate." We're standing outside Pinto's on the King's Road. I've just dressed one of its windows after leaving Harrods. I tested the water about finding new work while I was still there. And when Pinto agreed to employ me freelance to do their displays, I knew the time had come to make the break. Fiona and I cross the road and get into the car. It's a hot summer's evening, and we wind down the windows. I switch on the radio. "Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic" by The Police is playing, and Fiona smiles at me. "That's about right," she says with a giggle. Then we just start to laugh. Pulling out of the parking space, I turn up the stereo and start to drive along the King's Road.
Shop Girl was written and read by Mary Portis. It was abridged by Joe Coombs and produced by Hannah Marshall. It was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. Where, in a couple of minutes after the news, we'll be joining Jenny Murray for Woman's Hour. Today, considering how the police deals with issues of domestic violence, we'll be looking at the history of the title of the Princess of Wales and investigating new research from the University of Southampton, which shows that for young female students, experiencing financial difficulties may increase their risk of developing an eating disorder. That's all in Woman's Hour from Salford after the news.
The journalist Robert McCrum reflects on his experience of having a stroke.
When you're in the immediate post-stroke recovery period, you are very childlike in some respects. You're very needy. And you've been thrown back to a pre-adult stage in some senses.
Understanding the consequences of recovery with other stroke survivors, including Andrew Marr.
Beginning to come to terms with the fact that I will never be 100%. I will never be running again. I will probably never be cycling again.
The Life in My Head, from stroke to brain attack. Next Monday morning at 11, and then available on the BBC Radio 4 website.